From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The United States is now administering an average of more than 2.4 million doses of coronavirus vaccines across the country every day. But as of today, in 14 states, the average number of new infections is going up.
The number of confirmed cases in Texas has been going down, even though Governor Greg Abbott lifted his statewide mask mandate last week. The governor is now in a legal battle with the mayor of Austin, who has continued to enforce mask wearing in public. A judge has allowed the mayor to do so for now, but a court hearing will decide the case next week. Austin Mayor Steve Adler, a Democrat, joins us now. Mayor, welcome. It's good to speak with you.
It's good to be with you here. Thanks.
And on March 10th, Governor Abbott lifted the statewide mask order, and here he is explaining why.
It is clear from the recoveries, from the vaccinations, from the reduced hospitalizations, and from the safe practices that Texans are using that state mandates are no longer needed.
So those are the governor's reasons. What are yours for trying to keep masks on in Austin?
Well, we're trying to follow the doctors and the data to give us the best possible chance of being able to sustain more and more kids in person in school and to sustain the opening of businesses. We're not out of the woods yet. Here in Texas, too few people have been vaccinated. We have to drive down the positivity as much as we can to be able to avoid the impact of the variants coming into our city. We are so close. It's not instead of opening up an economy, it's what enables you to do it.
Do people feel compelled to listen to your order in Austin there when the governor is basically saying the exact opposite thing? Does it undermine you?
Well, I think people are confused by competing messages. But then, frankly, they were confused by the governor coming in and saying the mask mandate was going away. I think that's heard by many people to mean that masking is not effective or it's not necessary. I think it's really important for people to hear local leaders, our local health authority, very clearly, unambiguously saying it is important for people to wear masks. And we're going to do everything we can to help ensure that that happens. That message, I think, is critical for the community to hear.
Can you explain what that confusion means in the community? For instance, is it causing more conflict amongst people or for businesses there? How are businesses handling that confusion?
Businesses want to be able to have masking in their establishments, in part because they want to protect their employees. But they also are uncomfortable being the mask police. And if someone comes into their shop, they have an employee who has to try to enforce the rule. That makes them uncomfortable. But when there was a mask mandate from the state, their job became easier. They could say to the customer, hey, it's not our rule. We don't have any choice. It's the law. When the governor removed the mandate, suddenly they were put in this awkward position of having to be the decider and the enforcer. So I had many businesses ask me to make sure that we kept our mandate in as long as we possibly could.
The judge's decision here was not final. There's going to be a hearing next week, and the state is likely to argue that Texas should be able to set policy that supersedes cities and towns, and that local businesses should be the ones to decide whether or not to require masks. What's your guess, Mayor, as to what's at the core of this disagreement with you and the governor? What kind of politics are at play here? Because whether you like it or not, they are.
And it's incredibly unfortunate that masking became a political and partisan issue. And obviously that started with the then president. And really, I think that's held us back. It certainly hurt us in Texas and in Austin, where people believe that your decision with respect to masking shows your bona fides for one party or another. I'm real appreciative that the judge kept our mask mandate, local mandate, in place for 2 weeks. That gets us past spring break here in Austin with the University of Texas. I think that will help. Every day we can keep the local mandate in place is a victory for us. Hmm. It's a new area of law. We can't find any time in Texas history where a state leader has been able to overrule a local health authority with respect to maintaining the local public health. And we're hoping that doesn't start now.
Hmm. Do you have a plan for what you'll do if you lose that case in court? Will you respect the decision?
Well, we'll respect the court's decision. We'll continue to urge our businesses and our people to wear masks. You can't enforce your way to compliance of any of these rules, and that's been the case for the last year. And we've talked about that a lot with our community. There are not enough police officers and deputy sheriffs. It's got to be something that enough of the community wants to do that you set a kind of a cultural expectation for one another.
Before I let you go, I do want to ask you something else. As the mayor of a big city, I'm sure you're closely following this week's shootings in the Atlanta area. Many Asian Americans around the country are feeling scared today. What's your message to that community in Austin?
Well, I certainly understand the fear. It's also something that we have seen in Texas. We've seen threats here in our city of Austin. And I think that it's really important whenever we hear anything like this, that the entire community stands up in support to protect and to celebrate the Asian American Pacific Islander community, because that community, like so many others in our country, gives us the texture and the diversity that really gives value to life.
Austin Mayor Steve Adler, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
The Biden administration has sent crisis teams to the border to help with a record number of children being detained in jail-like facilities. One person who knows the condition there all too well is John Sanders. He led U.S. Customs and Border Protection during the last influx of unaccompanied minors, and he fears a repeat of what happened 2 years ago when at least five children died in U.S. custody. In an interview that aired on All Things Considered, Sanders spoke exclusively with NPR's Franco Ordonez.
It was about 2 years ago when John Sanders, the acting commissioner of CBP, made a public plea for help. He said children should not have to sleep on the ground under Mylar blankets in the United States of America.
I've been asked by numerous people about what keeps me up at night. My response is always the same. Every night I go to sleep praying that nobody in our custody dies of an illness or injury.
But about a week later, that happened.
Once again, the Trump administration is having to answer for the death of a migrant child who was apprehended by the Border Patrol. 16-year-old Carlos Gregorio Hernandez Vasquez died yesterday at a Border Patrol station in South Texas.
Today, as he sees the numbers of kids in custody rising, John Sanders can't help thinking about Carlos and two other children who died, Felipe Gomez Alonso, who was 8, and Jacqueline Call, who was just 7.
So this is the hard part. My greatest fear and the hardest thing for me when I was at CBP was the death of children. And my greatest fear is children will die. And that's what I think we have to make sure never happens. Sorry.
He says the children sleeping in cells are already physically and emotionally strained after weeks, if not months, of traveling under very difficult conditions. They're supposed to be transferred to shelters run by the Department of Health and Human Services within 72 hours, but currently it's taking 117 hours on average.
HHS has the capability in terms of medical treatment. They have the capability in terms of helping them psychologically. They're separated from families, and that has to be incredibly traumatic. So they have that support structure that they in place for the children that just does not exist from a law enforcement agency.
In 2019, Sanders says kids were arriving twice as fast as they could be moved to safer shelters. Today, they're arriving 3 times as fast.
My hope would be the alarm bells have now been sounded, and so what are we going to do as a country?
And he's not the only one who's concerned.
I'm terrified about the number of kids in these Border Patrol facilities. It's really worrying.
That's Clara Long. Back in 2019, she served as a detention monitor for the legal team that advocated for the children in court. She testified then to Congress about sick kids sleeping in cells and having to take care of each other.
On my first day in the Clint Border Patrol station, I spoke with an 11-year-old boy who was caring for his 3-year-old brother. They had been fending for themselves in a cinder block cell with dozens of other children for 3 weeks.
Now, Long largely blames the Trump administration for hollowing out what little infrastructure existed to handle these cyclical flows of unaccompanied minors. But she also raised concerns about transparency in the Biden administration and questioned why detention monitors like herself have been blocked from seeing certain areas of concerning facilities.
just because there's a different person in the White House, that doesn't mean that different practices have percolated down throughout this agency yet. They need to, but that doesn't mean that we're seeing change on the ground.
2 years ago, Carlos died of complications from the flu. So did Felipe. Jacqueline died of a bacterial infection. John Sanders quit soon after Carlos's death. He called it a transformational experience and now works with an organization, Glasswing, that works to address the root causes of migration in Central America.
What is heartbreaking to me is that history is repeating itself, and there is no surprise to people that this was going to occur. And again, I'm not making a political statement. It's just I think we as a country have to figure out and have some tough conversations so this doesn't keep happening again and again, because it's the children that suffer at the end of the day.
And that's why he says it's important to talk about them. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
It's hard to imagine how someone who grew up on a cattle farm in southern Africa and was married at the age of 13 could achieve all that a woman named Tarirai Trent has. Trent was raised in rural Rhodesia. That was a British colony. It's now the former colony, Zimbabwe. She dreamed of getting an education, but the boys went to school because they were seen as the breadwinners. Trent was married off and had four children by the time she was 18. But that's just the beginning of her story. She eventually got that education and earned her doctorate. Today, she runs Tarirai Trent International, a foundation that provides quality education to children regardless of gender or socioeconomic background. Trent is a sought-after speaker, and she'll be taking part in a conference on leadership at Simmons University next week. She says her main message will be to encourage resilience, especially in young women.
Resilience in terms of how do we get up every day when we are faced with these so many challenges? We have racial tensions. We have the pandemic, which has displaced many women out of employment. And how do we keep our heads up? And I'm going to share my own story of how I have managed to change the trajectory of my own life despite the many, many adversities that I faced.
I wonder if you would mind sharing some of that story right now. And I know you have before, but it is really such an incredible testament to resilience and exactly what you're talking about now. But you did not grow up in America. You grew up in Zimbabwe in a very difficult situation. Could you take us there and tell us what happened?
You know, I always say I come from this long line of generations of women who had been denied their right to education. By the age of 18, with no formal education, I was a mother to four children, married to an abusive husband. Also, I grew up under a colonial system of governance that had oppressed my people for many, many decades. Racism, you talk of all the ugliness that we see today. I lived that, and the remnants of that, we still see it in many third world countries.
So going back to that period when you said all you wanted was an education, your brothers were being educated, you were not. And so what did you do? How did you learn?
You know, because there was so much poverty, as a young girl, I would go graze cattle. And my responsibility was fetching firewood, walking those long distances, balancing a bundle of firewood on my head, and also fetching water because we don't have running water. But all I wanted was an education. And then I got married, like the women before me. We were all exchanged for what I call a freaking cow, as part of the marriage. And here I was, a mother of four, with no education, and I am thinking, what's going to happen to my life?
Take us back to that opportunity
that you had at the same time when you were in this abusive relationship and who you met and how they helped.
The fortunate thing is Rhodesia became Zimbabwe. We gained our independence. And all of a sudden, there were all these foreigners coming into our country. And some of them were women who were coming from Australia, America, Britain, you name it. And there was something about these women that inspired me. And I wanted the way they walked. They had some kind of dignity. The way they would read their papers. The way they would handle their bags. There was that kind of freedom that I wanted. And this woman from America, her name is Jolak. She came to the village and found me sitting in a circle with other women. And she asked me one fundamental question that no one had asked me before. What are your dreams? And I said, I want to go to America. I want to have an education. I remember there was silence because the other women I could feel and hear, they were saying, how can you talk of these things? You have an abusive husband, and let alone, how can you even dream to go to America?
I'm going to ask you the question that some of those other women around were wondering, I guess, and that's, how could you dream like that? And how could you say those words?
Because when I told my mother that I met a woman who inspired me, my mother was so happy, and she said to me, you will be the one to help us to break this vicious cycle of poverty. And I am reminded of being born into this relay race that I always talk about, the race where I ran holding a baton, and I call that the baton of early marriage, the baton of illiteracy, the baton of a colonial system that never respected black women and black men. And I am running with this baton, and I visualize my great-grandmother was the first to run with this baton because it had been handed from her own ancestors. And she hands that baton to my grandmother. My grandmother hands it to my mother. My mother hands it to me. And so I knew in that discussion with my mother that I needed to redefine this baton and never to pass it on to my girls, the baton of illiteracy. I needed an education.
You not only got your bachelor's and then master's, you got your PhD, and it's just hard to imagine how you've been able to surmount all the obstacles that were in your way. And you have said that at the most difficult points in my life, I had other women who gave me opportunities. Women can create fertile ground that nurtures, inspires, and enables other women's paths to grow and succeed. That's almost a direct quote. So how are you then carrying on that baton in the relay? What is your main goal now?
The main goal now has been to reshift that baton and to change that baton so I can pass on the baton of quality education, the baton where every child has access to quality education. And after I attained my PhD, I was very fortunate to have been invited on the Oprah Winfrey show, where she donated $1.5 million towards rebuilding my elementary school.
That school is thriving today, and she now has 12 more schools in rural Zimbabwe, educating thousands of students. There's more information about Tara I. Trent's Foundation at hereandnow.org.
And we're going to take a few moments now to remember a man named Dick Hoyt, whose devotion to his son made him a disability rights advocate. Hoyt was the father half of the father-son duo that became known in the running world as Team Hoyt. His son, Rick, lives with cerebral palsy. And their odyssey began in 1977 when Rick asked his dad to push his wheelchair in a 5-mile charity race for a friend. Dick remembered that day in a 2014 conversation with Here and Now.
When Rick came home, he told me all about it. He said, Dad, I have to do something for him. I want to let him know life goes on, even though he's paralyzed. I want to run in the race.
Dick said everyone thought they'd quit.
Well, we didn't. We finished the whole 5 miles coming in next to last, but not last. And when we got home that night, Rick wrote on his computer, Dad, when I'm running, it feels like my disability disappears.
If those moments were a spark of joy, what came next was a full-blown fire. Thousands of races would follow, but it was the Boston Marathon that won their hearts, even though organizers didn't make it easy for them.
They made us qualify in Rick's age group, and that was kind of tough, you know, because Rick was in his 20s, I was in my 40s, and that meant we had to run a 250.
But he did it, and their achievement galvanized the disability community. In 1989, they created the Hoyt Foundation.
When Rick was born, you know, we'd take Rick in a restaurant, people would get up and leave, then they didn't want him in school, then they didn't want us competing. We got all these other kids that are physically challenged out in the public now, and they're able to live, learn, work, and play just like everybody else.
But racing and time took a toll on Dick. In 2014, they crossed the finish line of the Boston Marathon for their 32nd and final time, dedicating the race to the victims of the marathon bombing the year before. Here's son, Rick, speaking through his computer before that race.
Many people have asked me what I would do if I weren't disabled. Maybe I would play hockey, basketball, or baseball. But then I thought about it some more and realized that what I would probably do first is tell my dad to sit down in the wheelchair, and now I would push him.
Dick Hoyt died Wednesday. He was 80 years old.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just help you keep up with the news, we help you make sense of what's happening. Like what the case about George Floyd's killing means for the ongoing fight for racial justice, or how to best navigate a pandemic that's changed life for all of us. All of that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
The Russian government is furious today after President Biden answered this question from George Stephanopoulos at ABC News.
So you know Vladimir Putin, you think he's a killer?
Mm-hmm, I do.
So what price must he pay?
The price he's going to pay, well, you'll see shortly.
After that interview, the Kremlin recalled its ambassador to Washington. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman joins us now. Hi.
Hi there, Peter.
Hey, so Russian President Vladimir Putin is not happy about that interview. He seemed to try to connect painful moments in American history with Biden's comments. What more did we hear from Putin today?
Right, exactly. He clearly didn't like being called a killer. He argued that people often project onto others what they are themselves. And he talked about America's history of slavery and atrocities against Native Americans, for instance. And, you know, just an interesting side note to all of this, when a Fox News host called Putin a killer a few years ago, then President Trump kind of shrugged and said, well, do you think our country is so innocent? So Putin is kind of echoing what Trump said himself.
Interesting. Well, as a result of all of this, as we said, Russia is recalling its ambassador for consultations. I presume that's a temporary situation, but just how common is all of this?
It's kind of a surprising moment, to show that they're angry. But a lot of this, I would say, is really posturing. I mean, the Biden administration has come out with some pretty tough statements lately, including targeted sanctions on some top Russian officials over the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, the Russian opposition figure now in prison. And they've, you know, tried to stand up to some really bad behavior of Russia these days.
Well, it is a tenuous time, isn't it? A new declassified report from the U.S. National Intelligence Director's Office is now saying that President Putin authorized efforts to help Donald Trump in last year's election. Do you think all of this combined and what you just described is damaging even further this relationship between Washington and Moscow?
It may. I mean, you know, Putin's spokesman today said he thinks that Biden doesn't want to normalize ties with Russia. He said that will guide Russia's policy from now on. But what you're hearing from the Biden administration is that it wants to kind of strike a balance. It plans to hold Russia to account for that bad behavior, like the poisoning of Navalny or interfering in U.S. elections. But it's also ready to work with Russia on areas where it can. Think about climate change, Iran, or Afghanistan. In fact, you know, the U.S. envoy on Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, is in Moscow now for talks. So the Biden administration clearly doesn't want all of this tension to get in the way of that.
Well, the State Department is also trying to thread a needle with Beijing. Secretary of State Tony Blinken is going to be meeting with Chinese officials for the first time in Anchorage. Let's talk about that for a second. What will that meeting tell us about relations between the U.S. and China?
Well, I mean, the approach is actually to China is quite similar to Russia. Work with Beijing where you can, but hold them to account on issues like human rights issues and trade. The other big part of Biden's approach is to get on the same page with allies. And that's why you saw the secretaries of defense and state in Japan and South Korea this week before these talks with China. In Alaska, the Biden administration wants to consult with allies first. They say this puts the U.S. in a stronger position to deal with China.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
With any luck, kids across America will be heading back to school soon for some face-to-face learning. For an entire year, many of those kids have been trying to do school on cell phones, tablets, or laptops. And if you're a parent, you know the screens don't usually go dark when class is over. The pandemic has exposed all of us to a tremendous amount of screen time. But as life slowly returns to normal, should we start thinking about weaning our kids off the devices? It's not going to be easy. Joining us now is Dr. Jenny Radesky. She's a pediatrician at the University of Michigan Medical School and lead author of the American Academy of Pediatrics Media Guidelines for Young Children. Dr. Radesky, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And why don't we start by looking at the root of this issue? Kids' screen time, by some estimates, is up 50 to 60% in the pandemic. Have you noticed this shift in the amount of hours that kids are piling up?
Oh, absolutely. I see it in my patient population as having to do with just not having other opportunities to connect with their friends or to stay occupied while their parents are working, as well as through connecting to virtual school. And this is supported by data collected from the app stores or from gaming companies showing that usage is up across the board. And platforms like Roblox have just seen enormous increases in the amount that kids are spending on them.
And now we're more than a full year into this pandemic. That's a lot of time to form a new habit. So what's been happening to our kids' brains in that time?
Yeah, we certainly have picked up a lot of new habits. I think the ones that we're trying to help parents try to avoid is just displacing all your boredom time, your feelings of distress, your feelings of big emotions. Don't displace or numb all of that with technology. It's so easy to because we have like endless options in our digital ecosystem. And we just said to parents, you know, this is a time where we're really going to have to work on our family's resilience. And those qualities are built through daily encounters with our kids, where we're having conversations over meals, we're getting enough sleep, we are getting outside, we're having conversations that address the emotional response we're having to such a traumatic year.
When you say that kids are, you know, hiding in their screens to run away from big emotions or fear or something like that, it makes me wonder, is it possible for kids to be addicted to screens?
You know, I don't like using the word addicted just because it places the problem in the individual child, not in the digital environment that is actually shaping a lot of those engagement behaviors.
I do hear that. I'm just wondering, though, if it's the same mechanism in the brain as, say, you know, if there was a substance abuse problem.
Yeah, pleasure and a lack of friction and an ability to get into a zone and get, you know, what gamblers call, a subjective shift, where like you just don't have to be as aware of all the stress and chaos around you. Yeah, there's definitely that same mechanism that I think exists within our very pleasurable digital environment, like kids' YouTube channels that are so filled with wish fulfillment experiences, watching kids open packages and try on princess dresses. And this isn't like high quality, nutritious content for kids. It's mostly just pleasure seeking and escapism. And hey, we all deserve a little escapism during such a difficult year. I think that the hard thing is that so many user interfaces are designed to not make us pause and reflect on, wait, how long have I been doing this?
I take that point completely. Maybe we should be examining that as much as anything else, and certainly maybe not blaming the kids for this. But I just wonder if you think that as life starts to resume little by little, kids are going back to school, maybe people are going back to the office soon, do you think it's a good idea to start weaning our kids off these screens?
I think it's a good idea for parents to be thinking about it. Some of kids' screen use will naturally decrease as they have more opportunities to go to a dance class or back to school. I don't want parents to stress too much that this will be really hard to peel back, because if we give kids a replacement activity that is fun and satisfying, or at least helps them feel like they're getting back to normal, I think kids will naturally be motivated to do those things. Of course, there will be some kids that struggle. And so if your child is struggling with motivation to do other things, fighting with you because they don't want to stop playing their video games, then it's time for a family meeting to talk this all through and say, hey, why are we arguing so much?
Let's get into that. Yeah. And I'll share my own anecdote here. I have a 12-year-old who every time I ask her to get off the screen, I have to like brace myself for her reaction. It's stressful. It's stressful for me. It's stressful for her. It's stressful for the whole family. How do you think families should handle that?
As a developmental pediatrician, I want to take one step back and say, what makes this stressful? What is one of the causes of your stress and her pushback to you? And one of them is the persuasive design of the technologies that our kids are using, like autoplay, like rewards and gamification and other things that get them wanting the next thing, the next thing. They have algorithmically predicted what your child might want to watch next. So they're not going to be able to resist that all the time. If you find that your kid is obsessed with YouTube, try YouTube Kids that has more timers. Try another streaming video site that has some of their favorite characters, but has some built-in, what we call stoppage cues that, you know, help your child just pause and say, oh, okay, yeah, I could take a break right now.
Do warnings work? In other words, 5 minutes left.
The more you can be proactive and say, okay, what's the amount of time you're going to spend right now? Plan it out. I sometimes say to my kids, okay, if you can turn it off by yourself, you can have the same amount of time tomorrow, because I want them to self-regulate their media use and show me it's not going to be a ridiculous battle every time.
What role do the schools have in helping parents figure this out? And the reason I ask that is that, you know, my kid went from really not even having much of a device to having a school-issued laptop that she's now on all the time, and that we as parents have very little ability to control.
I'm in the same exact boat. You know, I have an 11-year-old and then a 7-year-old who is just tech crazy. He's just going to be a hacker when he grows up. And they were initially so excited to have all this unlimited access to technology. So we did things like put on Wi-Fi blocks, you know, so that at certain times of day, the tablet or computer couldn't be online. We used the school district's device monitoring company, which was called Securely, to block certain websites. We only learned about that about a month into the fall. So we had this crazy month of our kids just on YouTube all the time or on video game sites, and that was exhausting. This was a rapid introduction to much more technology than many of us raising young kids were ready for. They could have done more proactively to avoid the kind of battle for your child's attention span that a lot of us have gotten into this year.
It's so funny to hear you say that your 7-year-old's going to be a hacker, because I think you make a really good point here. Like, screens are an important part of our kids' social lives. It is embedded into their culture, and far be it from us, you know, the old people, to say, oh, God, you shouldn't have that. You should do that. Do you think it's possible our concerns here are just overblown?
some concerns are overblown in terms of a blanket concern about screens and our kids. The concerns I see being more worthwhile to think and act on are not just how much time is my child spending with a screen, but what are they not doing instead? Are they not getting up and stretching and getting outside? Are they not refocusing their eyes? Are they not sleeping enough? But I also want families to have an open mind. If you ask them, what has this year felt like trying to relate to your friends all through screens? They might have some really interesting reflections, and we don't ask kids enough about what they're discovering. I think if parents, you know, join kids in their Roblox universe a little bit and see what they're building, same with Minecraft. If parents, you know, co-view movies and TV series and streaming series to generate some conversations about culture and race and society, those are really nice ways to not feel the anxiety about more screens equals, you know, child's brain is melting somehow. They really help you realize there's so much good stuff that can be carried through technology. Here's the distinction that I see, though, is that technology that's designed all based on ad revenue and keeping kids' eyeballs on longer, that's usually the technology that's not supporting our best interests.
Dr. Jenny Radesky, pediatrician at the University of Michigan Medical School, also lead author of the American Academy of Pediatrics Media Guidelines for Young Children. Thanks a lot. I mean, I know it was a help for me personally. I'm sure it will be for many people listening as well. Thank you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
This is the sound of pent-up pandemic exasperation. Welcome to Smash It 2, a place where you go to break things, where you're supposed to bash and crush and pummel. Customer Danielle Blanchard has brought a bag full of breakables to smash to smithereens.
Ex-boyfriend photos. Like, why do I even still have these? An empty bottle of gin.
Yes.
I have a sleep apnea mask. Like, this stupid thing that my dentist put in my mouth to
smash it. Sledgehammer.
Yeah.
Smash It, too, is in Worcester, Massachusetts. Its walls are lined with neon magic markers, scrawls from customers, little rants against cancer, Donald Trump, and against COVID. Its co-owner, Darcy Cook, suits up the customer, Blanchard, in goggles, thick protective gloves, and a helmet with a face shield. And then she takes her to her personal smash room. It's about 20 feet long and glowing in black light. Cook goes over the rules.
So if you want to hit something, we hit it so it goes in that direction.
Sounds
you
good.
You want to throw something, you throw it in that direction. Exactly.
There are two beaten up but still sturdy tables Blanchard can put things on to pummel. One of them already has a printer sitting on it. Sledgehammers and aluminum baseball bats hang on the wall, the tools of destruction. Blanchard wastes no time. She grabs a bat and starts pounding on the printer. On the far wall, there's a plexiglass window high on a shelf. It's spray-painted with an expletive and the term COVID-19. A rock tune from the 80s sets the mood. Blanchard picks up baseballs and hurls them at the plexiglass. After about a dozen tries...
Not breaking so well.
Success.
I got it.
Blanchard needed that. She's got a lot weighing on her.
Getting rid of my diabetes pain, getting rid of my COVID pain. The pandemic, like, it's been like a whole year. I'm like done.
She's a 39-year-old stay-at-home mom.
I have two little kids. And I gotta be the good mom that doesn't flip out. So I can at least flip out in here. Then hopefully I can go back home and be the good mom who reads the bedtime stories and makes dinner and doesn't get upset about little things.
Blanchard says after all that, she needs to break more stuff. Darcy Cook brings her a supply of vases, bottles, and plates. We step out of the room to avoid the flying glass and plastic. Cathartic shrapnel.
Stop!
sounds like this echo through the place all day. Cook says they're just part of her customers' stories.
We have healthcare workers come in here all the time. We just need a lifetime out. Not even just the hospital ones, but the counselors, sobriety houses. I mean, it's a ripple effect.
There are parents with teenagers sick of remote learning. Couples even come for date nights. Kira Halper and Dimitri Bertis of Boston came to Smash It Too to celebrate 7 years together.
And we're doing the seven deadly sins to celebrate. So this is our first activity, and it's rage.
The Smash Room opened in July. Darcy Cook says she and her brother risked opening the business during the pandemic because they wanted to get involved in the community, and they felt like they could use a timeout in a Smash Room themselves. So, you know, you actually could have set up like a meditation room with like soothing music or a spa or something like that. You obviously thought there would be a greater need in the community for a physical Smash. How did you decide that this is what people needed and that there is really a market for it?
Yeah, so my personality is not a quiet one. So I'm louder than loud, and I've done yoga. I love massage. My kids meditate. But at the end of the day, it just doesn't do it for me. We actually have a Smash It yoga here. It's loud. It's obnoxious. It's over the top. You still get a good workout, but we break. Oh, I can't say that. Sorry. We break stuff at the same time that we are, you know, in community with other women.
And what about all that stuff they're breaking? Cook says people donate old computers, TVs, microwaves, amps, toilets, anything they want to get rid of. The Smash Room works with local junk cleanout businesses to collect items, and recyclers take away the remnants. Customer Danielle Blanchard says in all those unrecognizable shards she left on the Smash Room floor, she accomplished something.
The pandemic is like, you can't, you can't, you can't, you can't. And the smashing was like, yeah, you can. Do it again. Like, do it harder. Do it like, Like, that felt really good.
On the way out of the place, she grabs a fluorescent pen to leave her mark on the wall. And perhaps feeling the afterglow of all that smashing, she writes something positive. Happy, healthy Danielle was here. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.